Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Wednesday, September 17th, 2025, and this is episode 3733 of the Survival Podcast, and I'm kind of, calling an audible or something here. I'm making an adjustment for today's interview. I had Patrick Seaman on today, and you're about to hear Patrick and I have a discussion of about an hour and 30 minutes. The problem is the discussion went about 2 hours. The first 30 minutes of it is I would consider largely unusable. We had technical glitches with streaming, and the guy you're about to hear from is literally like the father of streaming. This is the guy that created streaming when there was no streaming. It was like the universe decided to play a joke on me today and torment me. Patrick was also a mentor from my past. I met him back in the 90s. When you hear me talk about my days of knowing Mark Cuban and stuff like this, is one of the guys from that time. His story is amazing, and the story that he's told in his book, The Streaming Wars, is pretty amazing. His advice for entrepreneurs is gold, and it's going to be a great discussion. It's just missing some of the time. What I'm going to do, I am going to take the unedited first, it's really 40 minutes, but 10 of it's me blathering on about the intro stuff. I'm going to put that as an MP3 file on my server, but I'm not going to link it in directly with the show. I'm going to put a link in the show notes to where you can find it if you want to try to glean something from it. That will be up to you. I hate that this happened, but it did, and that's just the way things are. Given that I'm doing that, let me redo my sponsor segment at the beginning for you here. The sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone. Even if you're not ready to step into an Above Phone, an Above Tablet, or an Above Book right now, you probably want to get to AbovePhone.com. But go to AbovePhone.com/TSP. Now, that's not so I get credit for anything at all. But if you go there, that's a landing page they set up for you guys. On that page is a report you can get for free that's 5 must-know privacy settings for your phone. Even if you're not going to get off of the stock Android or the iPhone right now, there are things you can do to improve your privacy, and Above Phone will tell you how to do those for free. If you do want to pick up an Above Phone, remember they give $75 off any phone at Above Phone to MSB members. Check them out today. It's a great way to take back your technology. Next up today is Canine Academy. That is Joel Riles, one of my good personal friends and an awesome dude, member of the expert council as well. You can find all his stuff at canineacademy.us. In this instance, it would be better if you went by the site and clicked on the banner or the link in today's show notes to check things out with Canine Academy, because then I will get credit for it. And Joel's like the only sponsor I have that works that way for reasons, primarily because he's a very good friend and I want to help him out. And that's a way that I can make sure that I'm only getting paid for what I do for him. Joel is an awesome dude. He's got the problem-solving library that you can take for free. If you try that, I think you're going to love the way he teaches, and you're going to want to take at least the core obedience course. You can find all of it at canineacademy.us. Now with that, let me introduce us, and we're going to kind of drop into where we had already had the early part of the discussion. The early part of the discussion, we talked about the very beginning of internet streaming and what made broadcast.com different. I hate that that was lost to streaming problems while, again, talking to the guy that literally invented streaming. But I will give you just a little bit of information. And again, you can pull up the MP3, and it's not unlistenable, but it is. You can get the gist of it. But one of the things that we learned from Patrick before we jump back on it and fix this problem is that in the very early days of streaming, like, it's important to understand there was no streaming. We were on 14K dial-up when this started. Patrick was the first official employee, not really of Broadcast.com, but AudioNet, that later became Broadcast.com. And they had to do things, and you'll hear about some of the things. Like, I made sure it got covered in the good part of the interview, you know, like how he used to fly into places and run to Radio Shack for parts. I mean, that's how early on this was. We talked about how Broadcast.com was different from other players in the space, like Real Networks. They were a technology provider where Broadcast was a broadcaster. Their product was what you actually saw, not the technology by which you saw it, and how it's important for people to actually focus on their product, not their technology. That's something a lot can be learned from in the podcasting space. There's so many podcasters, they're more worried about their microphone, their editing software, their studio, their lighting, whatever, but they're not really worried enough about the content that they're actually putting out. That's something I've talked about for years. How about pre-roll ads? You hate pre-roll ads? Guess what? You're about to hear from the guy that created them. Patrick created the very first pre-roll ads, but it's because people were ripping off their streams and reposting them as their own content. So it was kind of hard to edit stuff really easily back then and all too. So he put a pre-roll in that was just basically, hey, you're getting this from AudioNet. So that every time somebody stole it, they were advertising for them. And then eventually they began selling that spot. And so this is the guy that created that. They also were kind of the people that created podcasting in a way with serialized audiobooks where they were releasing like one chapter a week. This is a really incredible story from a guy who really was there at the dawning of the things that we take for granted today. You're going to learn a lot by listening to him. Again, I will take that first part of the interview. I will unedited put it up where you can get it. And the video exists too, but the video may be worse than the audio stripped out on the other side. So, again, sorry about that. You know, maybe I'll get, if you guys really like what you hear from Patrick, maybe we'll get him back on and talk about some other things and kind of fill in some of those blanks for you. But, again, you're going to get an hour and a half here anyway. From, again, the guy that legitimately you can call this man the father of internet streaming. Right, maybe it's been long enough that you call him the grandfather of it, you know, but the grandfather, like, usually is the guy that did the thing that enabled the guy to. This is the guy that did it. This is the guy that did it. This is the guy that broke into Mark Cuban's house legally to restart servers because Mark's brother locked the door when Mark was away and the door was supposed to stay unlocked because they were running server farms out of Mark Cuban's upstairs extra room. I mean, this is how early on this all is. And you'll also hear me today at the end of the episode, after I let Patrick go, tell you something about who Patrick is to me personally as a mentor. That's a true story that I think means that some of you have learned a lot from Patrick before you ever knew his name. Because some of the business lessons I teach come directly from what I learned from this man back when I was a young, upcoming guy in the tech space designing data centers. And when I would spend time with people like Patrick, and that was one of the amazing things about that job that I had. Just a kid, right off the street, had went from running jobs to selling them, and I got to talk to people like this. I got to talk to top industry professionals. And if you wonder how I know the shit that I know, it's because my ears went open and my mouth went closed. And when people drop things that were golden nuggets on me, I remembered them, and as soon as I went out to my car, or if I was taking notes at the time, I made a side note, I wrote it down. That's a big part of what became Laws of Life. And in this case, he's going to drop it, and I forgot it was even him I got it from. It's so long ago, it's almost 30 years. And he drops it in the middle of when he drops it. I put it out in a text, but then I sum it up at the end, so listen for that. And with that, guys, let's go ahead and drop into the middle of the interview, but it's all gold. And we're live again. We'll call this part two, and hopefully it will go better as you guys come into the stream. If somebody can let me know if we have gotten out of the Max Headroom era of the 1980s, I would appreciate it. Right when we left off, Patrick had just talked about the botched merger and many of the other problems that happened in the streaming space that were connected to things related and unrelated to broadcast.com. We talked about how Enron's issues with Blockbuster screwed that pooch. And it took almost 5 years after all of this washed out for it to begin to kind of start over again at a time when tech was just booming. Are you there, Patrick?
Yep, I'm here.
Can okay. You hear me? Did you hear what I said?
No? Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
No problem. All right. Okay. Hopefully we're doing better. Anyway, but I thought you were trying to say something. It was me backfeeding through the damn system because, again, God wants to play a joke today. What I kind of wanted to go on to next, though, is one of the things I learned in your book, and I didn't know this even though I was working with broadcast at the time, was that you guys kind of sort of created podcasting. Like, not the way Adam Curry eventually did years later with RSS integration, which made us able to push our content out through aggregator services. But you guys kind of like started releasing serialized audiobooks.
Yes.
And if that's not a podcast, I don't know what is. Can you talk about that a bit?
Absolutely. And we did do RSS feeds even back then.
Wow.
As a writer, I had a friend who passed away last year, Jim Klein, dear friend, who had written a book, and so I was constantly critiquing it in our writers group, and I talked him into turning it into an audiobook. And he built a studio in his house. Sound familiar? And, keep in mind, he was an electrical engineer, so it wasn't a big stretch for him. And he started producing his book but he could only do it part-time. So he didn't do it all in one and give us a finished version. He basically could only send me it in like half hour segments.
Okay.
Which we put up once a week. And, this was, 1996, 1997. And, it was the first audiobook, on the internet, and it was serialized. And he did it, wasn't just spoken word. It was actually full cast with music and sound effects and so on. So it was an audio drama, and it was the reaction to it was profound. Keep in mind, remember when this is dial-up. We had 5,000 people waiting on 14.4 modems every week, waiting for us to release each episode. And then after each episode was released, we were excoriated at how horrible it was and how the aliens sounded like Texans and how terrible it is. And when's the next episode?
One
of the things that taught me was production quality is not as important as the writing.
Agreed.
Something that today's content producers could learn something from.
I think part of that is that we are capable of so much more today than we were back then. I don't think you were paying attention to anything I was doing back when I started the show in 08, but when I started it, I was still running several companies and still in that corporate world. And I drove from Arlington up to Frisco every day. And so I had an hour, hour and a half in my car. I actually began this show on a little MP3 recorder, driving my car to work every morning. And then I would listen to it in the afternoon for everything I did wrong. So there was road noise. There was occasionally yelling at another driver. There was one episode where I almost got literally almost got killed. I was stuck and a guy locked the brakes up and he moves over at the last second, slammed the guy on the shoulder instead of me. I had nowhere I could go. I dropped the F-bomb pretty hard in that episode, but everybody was really forgiving of it because they were focused on the content and where's the content that's better? Where today, we have nice microphones, we have filters, we have all. We didn't have that back then. Like that, even 08, we didn't have that yet.
Yeah. The production values. I mean, we took that. It ended up being 42 half hour episodes. So it was wild. It was popular, and it became the basis for a company that Jim and I later started after broadcast.com, and ran for several years, where we produced, we built our own production studio, and we did full cast, audiobooks and so on and other things. But we learned the lessons from that. We listened to the audience. You know, we were the first company to put an audiobook on a CD-ROM and include with that the ebook at the same time. And we bundled that together in a DVD type box. So what normally back then, when you bought an audiobook, it came, most people were still buying them on cassette tapes. And if they weren't doing it on cassette tapes, they were like CD, audio CDs. And so you'd have like, 30 CDs in this big, thick, binder, tapes or CDs. And, what we did is we took all that, we put it on a CD-ROM, included the audiobook, the ebook, and put it in a DVD-type box.
Yeah.
And sold them in Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
For like $19 when audiobooks cost $80. And, the buyer at, Barnes & Noble didn't like us, because it's like, well, we're selling these for $80 and we know who our demographic is and they are, professionals between the age of 40 and 60 with a high disposable income, blah, 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 blah. And that's who that market is, period. And I'm like, guys, I'm selling these to college students who are downloading the MP3s because back then they couldn't even download the whole audiobook, and they were downloading it in pieces, and I'm selling this to college students and young people, and they're discovering this content and they just didn't get it. That's a whole nother discussion.
Well, yeah. And another company that's out of business.
Yeah.
Right. I'd say it's interesting. I'm dropping a quote in right now for the stream, their competitors. And I believe it was actually Bill Gates, and I'm not a huge fan of Bill, but the right statement is the right statement. And it's the only companies to survive the modern age will be those who obsolete themselves before their competitors do. And what you're describing there is exactly that resistance to change. Like the whole market's going this way. If you told some kid, a 19-year-old kid in 1998, who was hanging out in a parking lot with his buddies cruising in the Blockbuster video parking lot, because that's where they hung out, right? Yep. And we did back in the 80s too, by the way, that Blockbuster wouldn't be there in 5 years. They would have thought you were smoking crack or something.
Yeah.
And this is another example. You got a bookstore selling a very expensive product. Here's a lower priced alternative. Make as much margin as you want. No, we don't want that. And so I'm trying to get business lessons across the audience along with this history story, because the whole, we study history to avoid the mistakes of the past. That works better with very recent history than it does with 300-year-old history, folks. It really, especially in business. Like Kodak had the digital camera in the 70s.
Yes.
Learn from this, there's a lot of media platforms that rose and fall on, on that note, right?
Yes.
And you've done a lot of consulting and guidance and mentorship in this space as well. So you've seen this happen. What are like the patterns or red flags that creators and entrepreneurs should watch for when dealing with, tech platforms today?
Well, I mean, you know, timing. We were just talking about that timing. You can be, prescient and ahead of the game, and have a great product, but if your timing, doesn't hit the market right, either too late or too early. What typically is, it's too early. You're hitting it too early. And I've seen that over and over again, with, with ideas. And the second thing that you run into is your, you know, A, do you have a monetization idea at all? You know, are you just trying to get market share and hope that you get a monetization model later? You see that a lot. Or have you locked yourself into a monetization model and you're not, you know, willing to iterate, pivot, change, evolve because something changed? The technology changed, the market changed, competitors changed, you know, because the fact is all that happens all the time. You know, technology is always changing. The market's always evolving. You know, with broadcast.com, you know, our initial business model was we were going to do five color commentary sports radio stations for, you know, and that was it. That was our business model. That didn't last very long. And I could go on and on about the business model of the day.
Yeah.
Because it felt like every day we had a different one because everything was evolving so fast. The technology was evolving so fast. The landscape was evolving. We constantly had to evolve. Or we had a business partner who, you know, there was a deal that we had where we could dial in and get the audio from a game and broadcast it. And we had this whole deal done. And it was this whole thing, you know, where people were like putting it on a credit card and they could listen to the game on their telephone. That was a thing. Believe it or not, that was a thing. And we actually had a deal with them where we were getting the feed and that fell through. And we had other, and it's like, then we had another deal with somebody else, you know, and then that fell through, you know, because of this reason or that reason, or, you know, maybe they were crooked or maybe they weren't, or who knows, you know, stuff was always happening. It was always, you know, there was always change and we constantly had to evolve. And, you know, I can find plenty to both praise and criticize Mark, about, I will praise him and our team that we were able to evolve and we were able to iterate and navigate through this rocket ride of 5 years that was just an insane amount of change in that amount of space. And it's eerie to me how similar that era was to what we're going through now, you know, with the AI technology and how embryonic it is and how many people are trying to make a buck off of it and how many people are, hey, I'm going to throw AI in my PowerPoint. Give me $5 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, this feels like 1995 all over again in a lot of ways.
We are an AI driven and focused firm. Like, did AI write that for you? Right. Like, you know, and I don't mean to crap on the tech because I think it's a lot like the internet that, in 1998, all the people buying stock knew the internet was the future. Mm. The problem was there were like 8,000 companies that were going to be the future, and five of them really were. And a couple of them could have been, like broadcast, that ended up being destroyed. And a bunch of them were never going to be anything. And I feel like the AI space is like that thing. I make the joke, you know, did AI write that for you? But like, I have a course right now, I have students going through teaching them to use AI to develop their own businesses and how to do things like copywriting. And I'm showing them how, like, I can have my custom trained AI unit write copy for me that sounds like me. And you put it in an AI detector and the AI detector says 0%. Right. Mm-hmm. But that's understanding and leveraging the technology, where what most people are doing is treating, you know, GPT or Grok or whatever is like glorified Google.
Right.
And then companies are worse. They're taking like something I can build in 5 minutes, building one for themselves, customizing it so it looks like it's theirs, and now I'm AI driven.
Yeah.
And that, boy, that reeks of paying people in stock options, right? Yeah. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I do indeed.
You know, even the Simpsons made a joke where like the AI or the dot-com company was like, they had stock options on a toilet paper reel, and they were like, they were handing it out. Like,
That's what it felt like in 98, 99. So when everything went in 2000, I wasn't surprised.
Hey, you know, I used to say that, and I still, I have enough stock options to paper the Empire State Building, man.
Well, to be fair, they did work out for you in one place.
Yeah.
They did work out for you in one place. You actually did try to help Yahoo after the fact, though. You didn't immediately go off to do your own thing, right? Like, and I just don't think...
Short version.
What do you see right now, though? Like, another thing that's happening, and I've seen this, but I didn't really think about it the way that I'm thinking about it now until I read your book. There is a backlash about, like, who really owns the content.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about the creator, because the creator mm-hmm. will always own whatever portion of that content that they retain in any contract, right? I'm talking about the consumer. So yes. I get on Netflix and my wife loves Friends. Yes. And this is years ago. So I get on Netflix. We have like mm-hmm. the box set of all the DVDs of Friends.
Right.
And we get on Netflix and it's there, the whole everything. And I'm right. like, my niece and goddaughter, she loves Friends. So like, you can have the DVDs. A couple years later, no more Friends, right? Mm-hmm. It's gone. You have to watch Nickelodeon at night to see it or whatever. Mm-hmm. So things like that happen. Like, people start relying on these content libraries that they pay for access to, and then stuff just goes away. And that's one thing when it's like a Netflix. You kind of know now the Netflix model. Content comes in, content mm-hmm. goes out. They go to other services. They make other deals. Okay, fine. Some of this, though, is like people think they bought a movie on Prime or something, and then one yes. day it's just not there anymore.
Or it's been changed.
Oh, that was something else that I picked up in your book. And I thought about, I think you mentioned Star Wars in it. Mm-hmm. And what I thought about is how they changed Anakin's appearance at the end mm-hmm. after the whole thing where he looked like, after they made the prequels, he looked young again in the Return of the Jedi. But there was some more nefarious crap that's been changed, like because of political bullshit, like
yes.
editing Donald Trump out of Home Alone, right? Too,
yes.
right? Like stuff like that. Like, no matter what you think of any of those things, that's the original content as developed, and you can't see it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that, you know, I think the figure is maybe 70-80% of households still have a DVD player. How many of them are actually connected to anything, though? God knows. The figures I've seen, something like, the use has dropped something like 40%. You know, people are dependent on and don't even have, or if they do have it, it's in a closet or in the attic, you know, a DVD or a Blu-ray player anymore. So they're dependent on it. But it's not just, you know, movies. Mm-hmm. It's music. It's books. You know, Kindle. You used to be able to load a third-party ebook on your Kindle. You can't anymore. And just like movies and everything else, they can change that ebook that you quote unquote bought. Because you didn't really buy it. You just licensed it. The same thing with films. You know, what we're seeing is, you know, there's a growth in people that are setting up their own NAS, network attached, storage.
Dude, read the comment I dropped while you were saying that.
there you go.
That's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And so people are setting up their own libraries so that they have a copy of stuff. Because what's happening also is, you know, you talk about Friends disappearing, other things are disappearing. You know, there's an interesting, one of my favorite movies from the 60s is Forbin, the Colossus Project. The first real, serious movie about AI. Fantastic movie. It's not pow pow boom boom. It's very, very cerebral. But basically it's, guy builds AI to save us from the Soviets, and the AI basically says, I'm going to protect you from yourselves now. And we all become basically willing slaves of the AI. You can't get that movie anymore.
One. You can find it on YouTube, but it was memory hold the crap. And it wasn't a small movie. It was made by Showtime, but it had big actors like Sean Austin from the Rudy story. He was the lead in it. Now it's just slipped out of my head. It was based on a Kurt Vonnegut novel. The brain cell was killed by alcohol in 1998. It was about like the new kind of like dystopian world, and like they had these bands around people's heads that made everybody the same intellectually. And if you were too smart, they turned up your band. And if the band didn't work, they lobotomized you. And Sean's character ends up in this back channel organization that actually runs the world, but they let the world run itself mostly. And you don't have to be dumbed down to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And Harrison Bergeron, that was the movie.
Okay.
I rented that from like a Blockbuster in the 90s, and it was almost impossible to find. Like, it was too close to the mark for what was going on, and somebody somewhere pushed a button and memory holed the hell out of it. There's a lot of that that's happened.
Well, people are vinyl. Vinyl records, have come back. People are even buying cassette tapes. People are rediscovering, old media. But the thing is, it's a physical copy, that they can hold. So it is still niche. The trend is still downwards. I mean, people are, the trend is still streaming. It's Amazon Prime, it's Netflix, it's whatever. That's still where most people are and where most people are going. But it is interesting to me that there is some level of rebellion, against that and building your own or rebuilding your own library.
Well, all of us old farts are the people that were like in our 20s when LimeWire was a thing. Like, we know ways to do things, right?
Yes.
Said, like, wait till like the young people, and I'm talking like teenagers today, figure out that if you can stream something and that signal comes to your device, no matter what they do on the other end, it can be recorded if you are smart enough to do it.
This is true.
And like my son, back in the early 2000s, he was doing things like he had a Netflix subscription when they used to send the DVDs out.
Right.
And he would order all the new movies and burn them and sell copies for $5 on burned DVDs out of a book at his restaurant he worked at as a bartender. Right. Like, there is us old school people, and now even people in their 30s are part of that demographic now, like my kid. We know how to do these things, and if the more I think they do of what you're talking about, the more rebellion there will be. Like, if you can see a signal, you can record a signal. There's ways to do it.
Well, I mean, whether it's changing Star Wars to change Han not shooting first, to name it. I mean, you can change anything, and you talked about some of the things that that people have been doing, and you could do a whole show just talking about everything that's been changed after the fact in music and video and books, editing books after the fact. I mean, there's.
And so he says here, if there's anyone it's okay to rip off, it's Hollywood. But see, I don't see it as ripping off. It's like,
I'm willing to pay for it, but you're taking it away and you're changing it. That's
right.
Totally different.
No, I'll pay for it. Yeah. I'll pay for it. Now you pay for it, but I want the copy that I paid for.
Yeah. Some of y'all never owned a dual cassette deck and it shows, right? I could say nothing to my kid because in the 80s I was the kid at school that had the catalog of all the music.
Yes.
And I had four dual cassette decks running high speed dubbing almost nonstop by my junior year.
Yeah.
Right? I had it, right? Like
Maxell gold tapes and
from a poor place, man. Like if you could make money with a side hustle and $5 in 1984 was you could do something with it. It wasn't a lot of money, but you could do something with it. I think there will be more of this pushback because I think there will be, just based on the way things are moving, I think there will be more of this corruption of the original content and limiting of the original content or losing of something you thought you owned that you don't own. It's like money in the bank. There's really no money in the bank. There's a promise of money in the bank.
Right.
And I think there's a promise of media on Netflix or Hulu or whatever that can always go away.
Yeah. And then then there's the whole creator side.
Yeah.
Which is a whole nother story.
Do you think there might be rebellion there? Because I don't know if I have it in me. And if you're interested, I'll tell you about it when we're done because I don't want to put it on the air. I have this idea for a service that I don't know if I – at my age and my time in life, and I'm looking 5 years out toward retirement, I don't know if I have it in me. But I do see an opening here, especially for independent creators, to create services that are uncensorable and unalterable, but yet still allow for monetization direct to the creator, right?
Yes.
Like, I want to actually pay the person that made the content more than I want to pay the person that aggregated the content. I don't mind paying the aggregator for a service, but I want most of my money to actually go to the person that is the creator. And I think a lot of people are starting to feel that way.
Yeah. I have books on Amazon KDP, where I can directly, manage that.
Yeah.
It's a challenge sometimes, dealing with that. But you're also subject to, discovery. Because there's so much slop out there right now. And there's so much AI slop being thrown up, into Amazon KDP right now that it's killing the algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Even after, the tragic shooting, just this week, there were, AI slop books being thrown up immediately about it, trying to capitalize on that. You think about that and you think about, well, how does the creator, actually connect with its audience? How do you find your audience in today's environment? And that's a big challenge for creators.
Yeah, there's the KDP thing is like a blessing and a curse. I just dropped my book about the time you did yours, and we hit bestseller lists the day we dropped it. We're still selling books, but we did really well in that initial 30-day surge with my audience and all. And 2 days into it, there were Laws of Life by Jack Spirko workbooks with little tiny by, Emilio Estevez or whatever at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this is bullshit. They're using my name, my brand, my title.
Right.
I reported it to Amazon and they said, basically, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't expressly claim you're the author, there's nothing we can do. And I'm like, that doesn't seem right, but there's nothing I can do. Like, I felt the same way I did when my payouts from Google AdSense publisher went from 10 grand a month to $500. Like, this sucks. This is wrong, but I can't do anything.
Right. Yeah.
And I just think there is going to be more pushback. There's services now that are using
different technologies to make things more directly to the creator. Like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Fountain FM, but it's a podcast app that runs on Adam Curry's Podcasting 2.0 platform that allows people to pay creators, tip creators, stream money to create. Like, while you're streaming the content, you're streaming back Bitcoin. And so there's this direct relationship now. And then creators can actually, like, if somebody leaves me a really great comment, I can throw them like 25 sats because it all runs on Lightning, which is very inexpensive to move Bitcoin around in tiny amounts. And I see them as kind of like, they're so close, but they're so typecast and they're just podcasting and there's no way to set pricing or to say like, this is an audiobook series and it costs, you know, a dollar an episode or something. Like, you can't do that. It's all voluntary in both directions, which is fine. But it would be great if there were other ways. Like, I kind of see, like, if you had, you know, like when you read a Kindle book, you'll see like 500 people, you know, highlighted this one paragraph.
Right, right.
What if that person could say, and I'm going to tip the guy that wrote the book a quarter because this
there you go.
That's the kind of thing that I'm thinking that changes that dynamic. It's just limited to like 1% of society even knows what Bitcoin is right now.
Yeah, and obviously there's there's a lot of noise around, I'll just call it that, around the whole Bitcoin, you know, crypto and all of that. It's messy.
Yeah, yeah. You got to separate the two, man. We won't go there, right?
People don't know that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely.
That's what I'm saying is people are concluding them and they don't, yeah.
They don't belong.
That's what I'm saying is they don't, you know, they don't understand.
The reason I see it for solution in this space is you can't run a 25-cent charge on a Visa card. You can't do it. It's $1.50 to run a 25-cent charge.
Yeah.
So it's economically undoable, but we'll let that go because that's a different space. I want to stick with the space that you're in and that you've come out of. There is this shift back to physical media. DVDs, Blu-rays, vinyl. Do you think that's just is there like I kind of feel like a lot of the vinyl stuff, at least initially, was hipsters doing it to be hipsters. But I think
originally,
some of it is backlash, isn't it?
If you look at the if you go and look and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I don't think you can justify the kind of numbers that we're seeing just on people doing it because it looks cool on their counter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's a fashion choice. I think a lot of it was a fashion choice, but I think more and more, you know, I do think it falls into this category of, you know, wanting to own it. And, you know, there is, you know, the audiophile component of it. It is a different medium and it does have a different sound quality. You know, if you have the equipment and you understand it, so there's a narrow segment of the population that understand that. And so your true audiophiles are, you know, however many of them are still left will understand that. But I think a larger number, you know, are the people that are trying to own the actual physical media. It's tangible. I can hold it.
The people that start movements are generally never the ones that finish them. Like, started for this reason, but then people are like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Right. Like because I'm more of the digital guy. Like, I like all my music, all my movies, all of it in digital format, not necessarily on a disc, but it's the same thing. It's the same reason. It's because now it's mine. Now I own it. Now you can't take it away and now you can't change it.
Well, you know, I encoded my audio CDs so long ago that my son laughs at me and say, "Dad, you encoded it that way? That's horrible. You know, why didn't you do it in FLAC?" Or
So
I get criticized because I encoded it like 15 years ago or 20 years ago.
Because we didn't have that then, right? I love my grandson's like, "Why didn't you just use your phone?" Because it was at my house 7 miles away, plugged into the wall. And I'm from such a small place that when you gave somebody your phone number in high school, you just gave them the last four digits. Everybody had the same prefix, and you didn't use an area code. And he just, what? Like, Yeah, we didn't have that then. Like that's the older you get, the more you say that.
The first, I mean, you know, the first iPhone was what, 2006?
Yeah.
And, you know, I vividly remember I worked on a project where I was doing this. It was a wildlife video thing. And we were doing real time streaming from the animal's perspective in 2006. So I worked with the guy that had the patent, and so I came in basically as the engineer, and we designed this camera system. We had to iterate over and over again to build something that would actually survive. But we built this camera system that we would put on a deer. And you could see and hear what they're seeing and hearing in real time. And we were streaming it live, and the biologists are watching and saying, oh, it's doing this. Because they had like radio collars before they could track. Oh, it went here, it went there. But you're actually seeing and hearing their actual interactions in their environment. And I built this whole system to be able to receive the signal. Anyway, the guy that hired me to build this for him bought the first, you know, he had the iPhone, and the iPhone. This is not 2006, it was brand new.
Yeah.
He got so frustrated with the thing that we're driving down the road in his pickup truck out in the middle of nowhere. He's so frustrated with it. He can't get it to work. He threw it out the window.
And they were like $2,000 or something at the time, right? They were expensive.
They were expensive, but it was new, and it was, you know, had problems and, you know, user issues and, you know, hey, man, the technology, you know, don't forget what it was like back then, because it was not what it is now.
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, when I started this show, I went out and bought an iPod.
Yes.
So that I understood the space I was operating in better.
Right.
Right. And if people used iPods back then, I actually found one recently. I plugged it in. It still worked.
Yeah.
Like a 60 gig big brick one.
I kept one in my car for a long time, you know, that I had all my music on.
But you know what's not around? What was it? The Microsoft one, the player. The Zune. That died.
Zune. Oh, yeah. That didn't last.
That did not work. We talked about this earlier, but do you see any other parallels between, like, the early streaming era, that whole dot-com boom space, and what's happening with AI today, and specifically AI content?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Let's talk about AI content.
Okay.
And you're very familiar with this, and you know that you can teach AI, you can train it on your own material.
Correct.
You know, I can take, you know, 500,000 words from, you know, from my books, and I can now load all of that into ChatGPT in one block, which is I've only been able to do that for the last year. Be able to load that much content, and I can train it on my own stuff, and I can as long as I treat it like a junior intern.
100%. Okay,
as long as I treat it like a junior intern who doesn't really and it's like, okay, this is a junior intern who's from another discipline, who doesn't really understand what I'm doing, but he gets it kind of close, blah, 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 blah. You still got to go in and edit it. You still got it. And it's like, it does nonsense stuff, and you have to understand, it doesn't actually comprehend what it's producing. And the deeper the prompt, you know, the greater the risk that you start having for it going off sideways and hallucinating. you know, there's some mathematical studies just in the last week about that, you know, that, you know, the more, because it's a binary thing, the deeper the prompt, the greater the probability of, you know, of hallucination. I have found that hallucinations also tend to matter based on time of day. It's like if I'm working really late at night, it seems like it happens less. I think a lot of it may have to do with stress on the system. I think that it's like it's resources are getting constrained or something. And maybe during the day, you know, or peak periods, it's like it seems like during peak periods, I have worse problems with hallucination than in the wee hours. That's just anecdotal. I don't have anything to, I don't have any numbers to back that up. That's just my observation. But in terms of content, if you treat it like that junior intern, who is okay, but they're really, really young and they really don't quite comprehend what you're doing because it doesn't.
No.
Then you can get a lot done. I mean, even a couple of years ago using early AI, I was able to cut my research time in half. You know, because it's like, okay, what was my research? Well, my research before was search engines and diving down and going into, a thousand different web pages and, finding stuff. And it took forever. And now if I want to, research a particular topic, it goes a lot faster. I still have to research it. I still have to check it because, it made that shit up. It'll do that.
Yeah.
If you check it and you maintain it, what does he mean by hallucinations? Give you an example. I want to write a article about, streaming. All right. So find me news stories about streaming in last month in this particular topic. And so you give me like these five stories. Oh, those look interesting. Write a story about this, this, and this, and use this angle and blah, blah, blah. And I give it a whole thing. Well, guess what? If you don't go and actually check those sources, half the time it made them up. The sources don't even exist. It made up a source that's like, it sounds like it ought to be real, but it doesn't actually exist. So it can actually, it will actually make up out of whole cloth sources, links, stories. It'll just completely fabricate stuff. So, in doing that, go. And then I can tell, give me, five stories, but triple verify them.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes even triple verify them, they're all still fake.
Nah, it doesn't work.
So, but sometimes it does.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're absolutely spot on. And sometimes one or two of them are fake, and sometimes all of them are fake. So you can't depend on anything it gives you being real. Because it'll basically make it up in order to satisfy what you're looking for. It's as if it's trying to please you. It isn't. It's trying to please the algorithm mathematically.
Yeah.
Yes, it is that bad. So they have different strengths. Claude is fantastically better at writing than ChatGPT is. So as a process, what you may want to do is rough out an idea in ChatGPT, build a outline, and then go into Claude to actually do the writing. But even in doing the writing, it's going to go sideways on stuff.
It absolutely does.
So I'm going to still have to manage it.
Upload a PDF of one of my manuscripts for advice on my manuscript.
Yeah.
And then you'll say, I've read the whole thing and I've learned. Really? Tell me what the last paragraph is. And it the paragraph it gives you is not even in there. And you say, well, right. How many pages? It says 25 pages. And it's like, no, it's a 96-page draft. It doesn't I build custom agents with multiple checkpoints in them, and still sometimes they fail, but overall they do really good, and they're not hard to do. You just have to know how to do it.
Well, I mean, it's like, let's say I load Streaming Wars into ChatGPT, and I say, hey, ChatGPT, look through my book and find a pull quote that's relevant to this, whatever it is I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Half the time, it doesn't exist. It just made it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like something that would have been in the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it isn't.
I should send you the PDF I share with my class today of prepping for this interview. It might be interesting since it's all about you.
You know, then there's, what's the one that will create, you can load it in. It'll do the audio review.
Notebook LM.
Notebook LM. Thank you.
Yeah. That's an interesting tool.
Very interesting tool. The audio quality is amazing. To be honest, it really is. I mean, it really sounds amazing. The first time I did that, it was like I was blown away, you know, at how it sounded.
Yeah.
Now, you know, does it actually get anything right? Okay, pretty close. Mostly.
I think the less you give it, the more that's true. If you give it a 10-page PDF and that's all you give it and it makes a podcast-style format audio for you, it's pretty good. When you give it 10 sources, it really starts to hallucinate.
It's just not dependable. I mean, you know, I have given it an entire book and had it do, you know, an in-depth thing on an entire book. You know, so, you know, 140,000 words.
Yeah.
And I've had it come back and actually be, damn, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, and other times it's like, where did that come from? I mean, it's not even close. So it's just, the thing is, you can't depend on it. You have to treat it again. You have to treat it like that junior intern who maybe stayed up too late last night drinking, you know, or doing something else.
I liken it to you. Do you know who the character Spencer Reed is from Criminal Minds? He's like this super smart guy, especially early on in the series, but he has like no social capabilities. Yeah. Like he knows everything, but he doesn't necessarily know how everything goes together.
Right.
And he has a need to tell you things that have nothing to do with what you asked about.
Yes.
You know, like the other way I think of it is like, if you assembled a team that can actually do what it does, it's $1 million a year team minimum in salary. And you can buy it for $25 to $50.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is most people don't treat it like that team. If you were paying that team, you would be on their ass and making them do everything they could for you. But since it's only $25, people mm-hmm. just use it like a genie.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I think the best results you'll get from it are when you're working with material that you know fairly well. So mm-hmm. you have your bullshit detector is like, that's not right.
Yeah.
Or at least that doesn't sound right. And mm-hmm. that will make the output really useful. But if you try to talk about something with it you don't know, it's mm-hmm. really not good.
Well, I did an experiment where I took a screenplay that I had written a number of years ago and a draft of a novel that I had written that had some crossover elements between them. And I said, take these two and from that, write me an outline of a book that does this, 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 and this. And after washing it through several times and iterating, it actually did a decent job of pulling things out of those elements and putting it together. The trouble was the end result wasn't good.
Okay.
it was the end result, even though it had the elements, it saved me a lot of time because it was a project that I had wanted to do, but I couldn't actually use what it gave me because it read like, you know, some, you know, cheap, you know, Netflix movie of the day thing, you know. Yeah. It just didn't work, you know, from a creative point of view. It was too simplistic because it didn't understand. So it was trying to throw in bland formulaic things as filler.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense because right now, my actual concern is as it gets better, not being able to tell anymore, right? Right now, people that don't know how to use it, and then they put out content, whether it's video content, photo content, written content, I look at it in 5 seconds and go, Chad, I cannot just say AI wrote that. I'll be like, Chad GPT wrote that, Claude wrote that, Gemini wrote that, like Grok wrote that, right? Like I can instantly tell you weren't even smart enough to remove your EM dashes. Like, you know, right? Like it's like you need to tell the intern that runs your Twitter account when they make a thread to check shit. But I do think we're going to get to a point where maybe you can't, because like right now, like the video stuff, like anything with a dog in it, every dog in it looks like it's shined with, you know, like somebody used car wax on its coat or something. It's immediately obvious. And so the deep fake thing isn't really that useful yet. But part of why I want people to learn about it is just so, because the reason I can detect it instantly is because I use it.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people, like, the reason they get fooled by it is that, you know, when they, it's not this, it's that, is almost always, like, how AI writes, at least how GPT writes, and Gemini as well.
Yes.
But do you think that maybe we're in danger eventually of, like, not knowing?
I saw a story the other day about a poll that had been done where they took I think it was a poet, and it was like a, you know, they had like five poems or something, and like two of them were real and, you know, three of them were AI. And they asked the audience, which was made up of people who were fans of the genre, which ones they liked best. You don't want to know the answer. Because the real ones were from best-selling writers, and the ones that were more popular were fake, were AI. So we're not far. Now, this was short material.
Yeah.
So the truth is, we're not far from it, and yet we still are, because it's still doing something short is one thing, but anything that is longer form, you know, requires more cognition. Yes, you can fall into formula and you can copy other stuff, you know, so I can take, you know, a Taylor Sheridan script, you know, and a James Cameron script, you know, and I can like merge them or something, you know, and it can copy it and it'll sound like this. And yeah, you can do that, but does it make sense?
Yeah.
On the other hand, does anything coming out of Hollywood make sense?
Yeah.
Does any of the writing that you've seen out of these multi-hundred-million-dollar projects, could it have actually been better had it been written by a freaking AI?
Yeah, yeah.
I have to wonder.
Maybe it would. I mean, there was a dude years ago, maybe 10 years ago is when he dropped this thing. He calls himself Sir Mashalot on YouTube. And he took from like 2006 or something, like six different number one country songs from that year. He put them all together, and it sounded like one song. He had all six guitar solos on six layers of an audio program running at the exact same time. Then he picked up. Then he deciphered the formula behind the top 40 hit, and then created all with synthesizers and auto lyric generation. So it was like AI voice before AI voice, a new song using it. And when he played it, you're like, if they put that on freaking country radio, it would be a number one song.
Well, let me put it this way. AI generated Redneck Stargate.
Okay.
On YouTube.
Okay.
Redneck had me laughing on the floor.
Really? Huh.
Okay.
So for Scott Adams' theory that it can't do humor, then that's out the window.
Well, I mean, it was it written? How much of that was actually written? The video was AI generated video.
Okay. Right.
How much of it was actually human generated? I have to give. I'm sure that I hope that a lot of it was, guided carefully, by whoever put the thing. Because some of the stuff I've seen, it's like Soviet Star Wars, which kind of goes on and on. It feels Soviet because it goes on too long. I mean, some of it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
The video creation, even though, it's obviously, it's some of it now, some of this stuff is photorealistic.
Yeah.
The shorter stuff, the longer form is stylistic. It's not photorealistic, but it's getting there. To the point where, one of the things that I wanted to do back in 2000 was I was at, you remember it was Ex Machina, where they were taking, they were using video game and they were doing a voiceover in the video game to write a story. Their own unique story. And so they were using video game engines, for some popular video game, and they had a voiceover and they directed the, anyway, what I wanted to be able to do was to do something like that for our, genre fiction that we were doing full cast audio dramas for. I was wanting to have some way to generate, video to go with that. But we're to the point now where you're already seeing these video clips where they have the audio story in the background, but then they've got these, 10-second, 30-second, AI video roles that accompany the story.
Mm.
So people are already doing that. So,
and that to me is a good use of it, right?
Yes.
So I'm going to tell you an audio story and I'm going to generate video aids using AI. So that's and I think that's the best results we get is the collaboration, right?
It's a collaboration. So, we're not that far from, and there are some tools where I can go and I can put in a script and it will generate a video. And I've been playing around with some of those where I can actually put in an actual, like I said, script. It still doesn't give me what I'm looking for, but give it another couple of years. How far are we really from the, call it the Tony Stark story generation AI?
Mm.
Where I could take one of my books and put it into the AI and have it generate a movie. How far are we from that?
There's a lot of fear around it too. And I kind of liken it to, I bet you there was a lot of fear from writers when they came out with the printing press. I bet there was a lot of fear from writers,
Yeah.
It was the first video on MTV was Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yeah.
And yet MTV today is nothing but reality TV and the radio star is still there, right?
Yes.
That's not really what it was about, though. It was really about the 1930s when people gathered around the radio. But that's how people took it at, you know, and was it like 79 or 82 or something like that when that came out?
Well, it's a funny thing though. In 96, when we put the first audiobook on the internet, that's all it was. It was just audio and it was a story. Yeah. And it was, you know, if it had been video, it would have been paper mache sets. I mean, you know, it was cheap, but the writing was good.
Mm-hmm.
And people gravitated toward it and they were hungry for it. We've reinvented the radio serial.
Yeah.
We've reinvented the 1930s radio serial.
While people were living in their cars. That's the other side of it, right? Like, the biggest way I lose listeners, dude, is they start a business and they stop driving to work every day. Right? Like, I teach them to build a business and then they stay home and then they stop, like, that multitasking thing kind of drops off. Like, that's why I think audio is the most powerful form of marketing. It's the one form of marketing you can truly take in while doing something else.
Yeah,
like, right. You can't really, I know people do it, but you can't really drive and watch a video.
Mm-hmm.
But you can drive and listen to audio. You can run and listen to audio, right? Like, you know, but
and audio, you know, is very core to me. I mean, my project right now is a company called Sportsbug, and we're doing real time audio of the color of sports commentary while you're in the stadium. You know, streaming has a delay. You know, 30-second or more delay. So if you wanted to listen to a game while you're there in the stadium, the audio you're listening to is not in sync with what you're seeing in front of you. But what we're doing is we've got a technology now where we're actually able to deliver it to you in real time. So you're seeing and you're basically listening to the radio guy on your phone through your Bluetooth while you're in the stadium. We geofence it so the fans that are there can actually listen to their favorite, you know, audio commentator, you know, while they're at the game. And audio is powerful.
Huh. Yeah, it is. And you're like, technology is evolving. Like, I discovered something last night and I had no idea existed. I was at a baseball game for my grandson and my son has an app and he's looking at it. And I realize he's looking at the game, a high school baseball game.
Yeah.
And it's got the scores and all. I'm like, what is that? He tells me, I can't remember the app name now, but he's like, oh no, my granddaughter Tegan is much younger. Here's her team's version. And like, everybody has a channel. And like, he's like, right there, there's a GoPro on the fence and you can actually watch the game on the GoPro. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, and that was an app that anybody could have developed. I mean, it took time, money and effort and talent, but like, it was sitting right there. Like, I don't think people are seeing, I think people think like, it reminds me of the story. It's not true, but supposedly they wanted to close the patent office because everything had been invented. the people kind of are there now. They think like we've hit this like peak of tech and there's nothing left as a small entrepreneur to grab onto and develop. And that's one of the reasons I think they should read your book. I'm like, guys, this dude used to like fly into a city where they were going to do something like a game or something and stream it. And the first stop you made was what? Radio Shack.
Yes.
You would go to Radio Shack and buy a bunch of shit. Like, Radio Shack started stocking things because they thought they were in demand because you were running around the country creating art, like, one-off demand. Like you might need 20 of these things or 100 of these things, but no one else was going to buy it.
Right.
You might have put Radio Shack out of business. They might have screwed up their inventory because of you. It might be your fault that we can't get cheap batteries anymore.
Yeah, I take the blame for that. One of the things that, you know, I mentioned how we set up this network of radio stations. And one of the ways that we would do this is I would set up, you know, an encoder server at a local ISP, internet service provider. And I would need to tune into the radio station. So one of my guys would have to run a cable outside to get the signal. But the problem was at the time, you needed a physical radio. Well, most radios actually had like analog dials. So they actually had a knob, and the knob, actually, if you open it up, there's like a string inside and it's like, it's all mechanical. And over time, the signal would drift off of the channel. So what I ended up doing was Radio Shack had these $100 digital radios so that I could just tune in the radio and it would stay on that station. So all over the country, I would go, and it was like I would typically have like at least two radio stations in a city that I had signed a deal with. And so I would need two radios. So I would go to Radio Shack and I would buy all the radios that they had. And what it is they had two. Every Radio Shack had two of these digital radios. So I'm like flying all over the country, and everywhere I went, I would buy those their inventory of two radios. And, you know, I would buy, and then if I only needed one, I would still buy two because I would need it somewhere else. And by the time I was done with that and our physical model changed and I was able to do it differently, Radio Shack was now, they started to stock all these, and they had a whole bunch of them. And it's like, by the time I stopped buying them, they had all these radios on the shelf that they weren't selling because I was the only one buying them all over the country. It was, I felt bad about it.
I loved reading about that because I knew a lot about what you were doing back then, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that, like, that literally, like, the streams we were watching were going across Radio Shack equipment, and it was such a guerrilla warfare tactic.
Well, it was cheap. I had to be
very, very advanced technology, but in the interim, to make something work, you were using all this stuff just put together. But like I was saying in the chat there, but Radio Shack shit worked.
It worked, and it was cheap.
And it was cheap.
And I could find it. And you know, over time, as I'm doing live events, you know, we learn things. And it's like I would need, you know, electronic parts. I would need connectors and adapters and stuff to deal with, you know, video problems and audio problems. And so I need all this stuff. And it's like over time, our road kits, you know, got better. And we have stuff, but stuff breaks, you know. And it's like one of the lessons I had my guys. I said, "Look, hey, that cable's iffy. It's not maybe it, you know, has a problem, or whatever."
Yeah.
I said, "If that cable has a problem," so I'd walk up, I take that cable, and I cut it in half.
Never use it again.
Do not put it back in the case because then you'll have that same problem again at the next event you're doing. I mean, gradually over time, we got better equipment. We could afford better stuff. But still, we generally, something always breaks. Or you get there and there's something, oh, yeah, well, we didn't know we needed to do this too. And so, you know, it's like we never had enough stuff. We never had everything we needed. And Radio Shacks were everywhere. And so, yeah, their stuff was cheap. And it broke, you know, over time, you know. But it was cheap. And I could get stuff done. I got shit done.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, if you have parts that can fail, then there should be reserve parts.
Yes.
And the fact that they're off the shelf means you can always get them.
Right.
Like, we build a lot of systems that we teach people how to build for, like, backyard aquaponics and all. We try to use things that anybody can buy anywhere because that way, like, if you're using a pump, just buy two, not one. Two is one is none. Put one on the shelf. Put the fittings on it that it needs to go into the system, and when one breaks, it's 10 seconds and it's replaced.
Right.
Right. That cable will be the same cable, the same connectors, the same length. Right. It has a part number, and it's in the kit, and boom, it's in. Like, I remember reading that in your book now that you say that you cut the cable in half. Like, it has to go. It can't ever be here again. But I bet, like all of us our age, you have a bag in your closet full of cables that you kept because you might need them someday.
No, I've got boxes.
Boxes, all right.
I have crates of stuff. I've tried to get rid of stuff, and I have, you know, but I still have a lot of stuff I'll never use.
I still have, like, old Fluke DSP bags that are just stuffed with HDMI cables, the RJ40, like, every cable that ever would exist. But yet, when I need one, I go buy one.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to find that, and I don't remember where that is. I'm not, like, my granddad could be like, Grandpa, we're looking for this thing. And like, if you go into the junk pile in the back and you go to the back of the junk pile and you move these five things, it'll be under there. And you're like, and it was.
How many boxes of Walworts do you have?
Of what?
Walworts.
No.
Little power, you know, Walwart, power, yeah. You know, little power adapter.
No, I toss those. I really do because they never are the same.
Well, I mean, that's when I have a whole.
You have a whole bunch.
I have boxes of those, and it's like, oh, you need a, you know, 2-amp, 3.5 volt.
Yeah.
With this connector.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Give me a half hour. I'll find one.
My big hack for all that, those things is the 6-inch extension cords so that you can use a power strip and have like 20 of them and they don't take all the space up. That's like one of my electronic hacks. Getting back in, entrepreneurs that are just starting out in tech and media, you have a lot of hardware one lessons. I go back, you go back further than me. So there's a lot of wisdom there. What should people that are getting started right now, tech, media, content creation, you know, marketing that stuff, what are some lessons you have for them?
Don't get hung up on the toys. Don't get hung up on the technology. You know, people get so focused on the technology that they lose track of the problem they're trying to solve or the thing they're trying to create. So they spend more time trying to, you know, get Photoshop to work than they do on what they're using Photoshop to make.
Mm.
You know, or name your technology. You know, it doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
It's focus on the product rather than the tool. You know, focus on the writing. You know, the focus on the story, you know, what is it that you're trying to actually do? What is the problem you're really trying to solve? And don't get hung up on how. Focus on what. Because the how changes, the technology changes. And chances are you'll find a better, cheaper, faster way to do it anyway. You know, after you spend all that time doing it, you'll figure out I didn't have to do it that way in the first place. Now, sometimes you have to do that to find out, but don't lose sight of what it is you're actually trying to create.
Yeah, the Adobe customer buys the Adobe software, but the person that uses Adobe is not selling Adobe software. They're selling what they put out the other end of it. And that is something, and I would tell you in MySpace podcasting especially, there are people that have, you know, $200,000 studios now to do a podcast, and their podcast literally makes no money.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm not putting down good quality or anything. I'm just saying that, you know, my Blue Yeti works pretty good. That's what I'm saying, you know.
I'm sitting here with a Yeti, in fact, and they work just fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same. Look, folks, you know, it's the same if you're, you know, you're a carpenter. You know, do you spend all your time, you know, sharpening your tools? Or do you spend your time making something? You know, what are you more concerned about? Are you more concerned about your tools or are you concerned about what you're making with them?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that you look at the content that comes out today in popular media and it seems like it really feels like, oh, we've got all these cool tools. We've got to use them. Instead of, what are we trying to say? What are we trying to make? What's the story we're trying to tell? And how do we make that better?
Mm.
And instead it's like, oh, I've got a budget, you know, to do this. Well, we need to spend that money on special effects.
Yeah. Yeah.
Spend more money paying the caterers than you did on the writers.
That's pretty common. Man, boy, I remember the 90s. God, the trade shows and stuff that I would go to.
Oh,
like
Comdex.
Vegas. And, like, no, they got, like, dudes in motorcycles spinning around in the metal steel
sphere.
And
I did Comdex,
circus, yeah. Circus of lay people and dudes, like, balancing on knives in their mouths and shit. Like,
yeah.
that's what was going on. And then it was like, I can't believe it went bust. Like, I can't believe it took this long.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, and I was in a business where every 2 years we were upgrading people's cabling. Oh, mm-hmm. Cat 4, Cat 5, Cat 5e, Cat 6, right. Cat 6e, right? I don't even know what the hell they use for data cabling today, what they call it. Like, is it 17A or something? I don't know. Like, but like none of it was really needed.
Yeah.
The infrastructure was fine. It was the backhaul and everything that was lacking. And I think today we have that in spades. But I think creators need to be also thinking about how to do things differently. I think we have way too many people just trying to take a thing that's on TV and recreate it on the internet. Instead of like, you don't have the time limitations, the constraints. If you're going to do something, let's say a fishing show, then talk more about like how you found the spot. There you are catching fish. Well, so what? You know, I mean, like, how does that person watching that take that information and they're watching you in California, but they turn around and they use what they learned from you to find a place to go fishing in Alabama?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that kind of approach. And that's just, I'm not typecasting. That's one example. Instead of recreating what exists, we need to be creating something different, something new, something with at least a new angle.
Well, you know, who's your audience? What problem are you trying to solve? What story are you trying to tell? What and what story are you trying to sell? You know, because ultimately you've got to sell that story. You know, it's got to make sense. What's the hook? You know, what are people going to get out of it, and why? And whether that's a creative thing or whether that's a product, and it doesn't matter what it is. You are creating something that you think somebody else needs or wants. You know, that's what you got to be focused on is the product, you know, and not the tool. You know, now if you're selling the tool, that's okay. But that's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I got you. Like I said, it's fine for Adobe to worry about how good Photoshop is. It's their product. Yeah. Right. Like they should worry about that, but it's not your product.
Yeah.
And replace it with whatever you use. Right.
Sure.
You know, it's fine for Wilson to worry about the golf club. You need to put the ball in the hole. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what it comes down to. What is your actual objective? One of the things I've noticed, and I wonder how you feel about this. I talk about it with my students in the marketing course all the time. My biggest job as a consultant was always to find out what the company did. And usually when I asked, like, especially if you had like six people from the company that were all like, you know, the CTO and the marketing director, and what do you do? They all gave a different answer and none of them really knew what they did. And that's not fair. It's not fair because they did know what they did, but they all knew their particular thing that was really important to them. And none of them really understood what they did that the market cared about.
Right.
And that was always my job to pull all that out, basically tell everybody shut up and go away. And a week later, come back and go, here's your messaging. And then they're always like, oh, how did you do that? I listened to you and I didn't listen to you. Two separate skill sets. I had to know when to tune you out and when to listen to you. And then I took everybody's piece, put it back together and said, now I'm the customer. What do I give a shit about?
Mm-hmm.
And that is something I think people really struggle with is understand your message to your market does not need to be all the things. It needs to be what your market cares about. Tell your story, marketing. Get other people to tell your story, viral marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Simple. But everybody complicates it.
Well, and you can't afford to do that because there's so much noise. There's so much attention for eyeballs right now that you can't afford to make your message muddy.
Yeah. One of the things I've said to this audience a lot over the years, it's easier to get people to give you money than time.
Ooh, true.
And it's because everybody wants your time now. So people spend money all the time without even thinking about it. They're spending more time thinking about where I spend my focus, my attention, right? Because that doesn't usually cost them anything to watch or to listen or to read, or it costs them a very small amount of money. But they only have so many hours a day, and now everybody's walking around with a device in their face constantly. And there's a million people competing for that attention. So you have to give them something different and worthy of their time. And I think that's something that a lot of creators fall short on, or they see somebody successful and they just go out and copy it. Like literally, you know,
literally
copy it. And that's not going to work either, because you're not that person. You're not that either. You don't have first mover advantage, or you're simply trying to be what you're not. And I think what breaks this is authenticity, right? You know, like you can tune into my podcast and hear me go, yeah, God hates me today, and he's screwing up my live stream with the father of streaming. And you get that from me. You won't get that on TV. You're not going to get that on a polished brand. It's just not going to happen.
Well, keep in mind that, you know, you talked about how in your book that you had people that were using your cover, you know, using your material, you know, and that's the thing, is you've got these content mills out there, and now they're being charged up with AI tools to accelerate that even more. So it was bad enough before. You know, now you've got, you know, examples like you gave of just bald face copying what you did.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, and you see the same thing, you know, on YouTube, where you'll see people, you know, taking somebody else's video, you know, and just blatantly ripping it off, just so that they can get those views. You know, I mean, it's the same thing everywhere.
Yeah.
But if we multiply this by, you know, let's just say a not America, other country where people are doing this in vast rooms of people that are, you get the idea.
Yes, I do.
you know, to mill that. Now you throw AI tools at them. It's not going to get any easier for your unique message and product and story to get the attention of people. And it's I'm not sure how we deal with that, other than the kinds of things we've been talking about.
Yeah. I think it's, again, understanding the technology, knowing how to leverage it, differentiate yourself, and being original, right? Like,
and you've got to keep going. I mean, you've got to keep innovating. You've got to keep doing, you know, you can't stand still.
Yeah. Can you tell people about your book and the work you're doing now, and where they can learn more about you?
Well, Streaming Wars it's on Amazon. It's also on Apple Books. Just look for Streaming Wars by Patrick Seaman, and it's on hardcover, paperback, and ebook. So different versions there. I'm currently my full time focus right now is on Sports Bug. As I mentioned earlier, doing stadium venue real-time audio, which is a real fun project we just launched with Learfield and University of Oregon, doing our first broadcast with fans, and expanding out to other schools and pro teams here soon. So it's a lot of fun.
Awesome, man. And I have reviewed your book on my site. I definitely recommend people pick up a copy and read it for the business insight, the history lesson. But it's also, if you are 40 or over, it is a fun journey through the evolution of technology. And you'll be like, oh, I remember that. Oh, I remember that. If you like the videos people do of, like, do you remember in the 80s when, you know, Pizza Hut was awesome? And if you like that, you'll love his book. It's the technology version of that kind of view. And what you were talking about earlier, like, this is who you're arguing with on social media.
Yeah. Right?
This is, for those that are on the audio only, which is like a 1,000 to 1, honestly, it's like one dude, he looks Asian, he's sitting in front of a computer screen, he's got like freaking 100 cell phones all logged in as different accounts on different social medias, and he's running basically a bot farm.
Yep.
And this is not just going on for politics in social media. This is going mm-hmm. on anywhere you can make money. If you have access to low-cost labor to do things like this, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. And you got to stand out, and you got to do something to stand out. And I final thought from you, maybe, like, I feel like even if you're not in the creator business, you're not a podcaster, you're not a writer, mm-hmm. you're not a musician or whatever, content creation needs to be part of what you're doing in the modern age. Like, you are not going to get somebody to pay attention to you with just like a brochure website from 2002. It just isn't going to happen.
The nature of human beings from the earliest days, we are storytellers. We relate things by telling stories. If you have your favorite hammer, how do you tell someone about that hammer? You tell them about the hammer because of how you use it. You tell a story about how, hey, I use this hammer to build something or other. I'm just making up a story here. But that's the whole point. Everything we do that we want to explain to someone else, that, you know, if we have a product, you're telling a story. So no matter what you're doing, you're telling a story. And you need to understand the medium. You need to understand how people are relating to things these days. You need to understand the way that media is consumed. And you need to keep track of where the technology is going. But most of all, focus on your story. Focus on telling, you know, a genuine, unique story about what it is you're doing, whether it's your music or whether it's a product, you know, no matter what it is, make it unique and make it real.
Awesome, Patrick. Well, hey, this has been great reliving this with you. I really appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thank you. It's great, and it's great to see you again, man.
Yeah, yeah. And before I let you go, is there anything left you want to tell the audience before I close up?
Last thing I'll mention, Streaming Wars, it does talk about the early days. It does talk about how we did it, but also I talk about everything from then to now. So it's the whole 30-year journey, both of what has happened in the industry, but also how the technology itself has evolved and the technologies and how they work. So there's a great deal of information in here to absorb and understand, so that you understand how are you consuming your Netflix? How are you consuming all of these things? And the book will tell you.
Awesome. Well, hey, I really appreciate you. Thanks for being with us today, and thanks for riding through that tech glitch. I think even if the audio out of that first part of the interview isn't good, we got gold from the second part. Again, the book is Streaming Wars. It's available on Amazon. It will not harm Patrick in any way if you go and get it through the review that I did on my website. I'll make sure there's a link to that today in the audio notes, and that will give me a little tiny commission as an Amazon affiliate.
Absolutely.
Which helps the show. Always do your shopping at tspaz.com, no matter what you buy, and you'll help us out. Patrick, again, thanks for hanging out with us today.
Thanks, man.
All right, real quick, I just want to say something that Patrick probably doesn't even know. Patrick was a mentor to me when I was young. And when I say young, I was like an early 20-something when I first met this dude. During this interview, he was talking about things, and I put a thing in the video. Who are they? What do they want? How do they want it? He probably has no idea that I got that from him when I was like 23 or 24 years old, working as a salesman and a network designer for a company called Data Connection. I remember him saying that because at that point in my life, I was out there trying to learn all I could so I could become a success. And so it didn't matter who I met, where I met them, or what they were doing. When people dropped wisdom bombs like that, I was back in my vehicle after that, writing that down. And so I've shared that with you as part of my business mentorship with you guys many times over 17 years. You just heard from the source. That's where that came from. Anyway, with that, as I wrap up again, sorry for the choppiness in the audio in the first part, but you know, we got an hour and a half with Patrick Seaman. That's pretty badass. So Hopefully, even if the other side of the audio doesn't work, that will be what maybe I'll put out in the audio side today. Real quick, though, I did mention tspaz.com, and that is because you can absolutely help out what we're doing by doing your online shopping there every day. So I really recommend you check that out. My item of the day for you today is the same as it was yesterday, which is the TP Deco router system. This mesh system has made my life so much better. Please don't blame this system for the choppy audio crap that we had today. I'm down to that one was probably StreamYard, and other times it's happened, it's probably the damn USB-C connectors on a MacBook and some interference because, well, the first generation of MacBooks to use them sucked. And so I'll figure out what to do with that. But this, I have had people here at my workshops, 80 people slamming my network at once and not a hiccup. That's pretty impressive. They all act as individual nodes on your network. You can buy a 3-pack of them, but if you decide I want another repeater somewhere else, you can just buy another one and set it up in seconds, and it works. The app is super simple. Anybody can use it. Even a technophobe can use it. And, again, it's available on sale this week. That's why I'm recommending it. TP-Link Deco AXE5400 Tri-Band 6E Mesh System. You want it, you know you want it. Go get it and make your life better. No more dead zones in your home. Thank you all for tuning in today. You should pick up Patrick's book. If you have not picked up my book, Laws of Life, yet, please do so. And if you have, either give it to a young person in your life, the 15 to 35 demographic it's perfect for, or buy them another one. That would be even better. Take care, guys. Thanks for tuning in today.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, others will follow. The revolution.